Very good. So, last weekend I was in Indonesia teaching a little retreat and giving many talks and doing my usual stuff of signing books and having my photograph taken. It's my karma now. So, you accept it, you make peace with it. But what was wonderful was just coming back on a Monday afternoon and getting out of the car which had taken me back to Bodhinyana Monastery, getting out of the car and just walking, you know, to my room, my cave, and just being really appreciating just how silent is that monastery in the afternoon. The silence was just enveloping, caring, and so, you might even say, holy, spiritual. Sometimes those words, the last talk I gave 2 weeks ago about the holy life, but this is a more serious talk. Even that was serious as well, because sometimes people take those funny stories to be superficial, but if you look deeply into them, there is some amazing wisdom in there. And because they're funny, they're easy to remember, which is, you know, the way they get into your brain, and they remember it, and they help enormously. But this particular talk about the power of such silence, I know that Eckhart Tolle wrote that amazing book, Power of Now, but this is even greater power, the power of silence. And that's to feel that in a very privileged to be in a place like a Bodhinyana Monastery where it is, nothing moves, and the silence of the forest in the afternoon is so calm, so quiet. And it's true that it's very rare to find a place, even in the jungles, the forests of Asia, there's always something moving there. There's always some cicadas or, unfortunately these days, aircraft or car noise. But that place, the right time of the day, is so quiet. And even if it's not just being in the forest, it's just, I'm fortunate to have a cave, which is incredibly quiet and silent. And those silent places are so powerful in relaxing your body, in healing your body, giving the body some great peace, and also for the mind to recover, and also to understand that the greatest wisdom comes from such silence. But unfortunately, the many times that people do their best to destroy silence in our modern world, and don't recognize it, protect it, and respect it, you know, when it's when we have it. And this afternoon, coming back here in the car, I was reminded just of a little anecdote. I was trained as a monk, to talk very little. In fact, a lot of the time, you would hardly speak at all. And so when I first came to Perth, I was the number two monk, and Ajahn Chacko was the senior monk, and he did all the talking. And on a Friday night, not here in our centre over in Magnolia Street, I would sit here totally quiet and silent, not saying a word, just meditating, just listening, and just serving in whatever way I could. I remember this because after a few months, Ajahn Chacko had to go off to Thailand, and so I had to look after the Friday night and Saturday afternoon and Sunday program at the temple, the previous one to this. And I started giving a talk. And I do recall this young lady, I see her here every now and again, she still keeps coming along, she will confirm this anecdote. As soon as I had finished my talk, she came up to me and said, "That was amazing, that was astounding. You can talk. I thought you were brain damaged," he said. She's about 7 or 8 years of age at the time. And I always remember that. Of course, I burst out laughing because it was just so funny that in the culture of the West, that we feel that if you don't talk, that there's something wrong with you. And in my particular case, she's seen me being silent for such a long time. She thought there was something terribly wrong with my brain. And I thought the opposite, there was something terribly right with it and healthy, with like learning the power of silence. Because what it also taught me was that when you have verbal silence, when you don't talk too much, it means that you're listening a lot. You're communicating. And of course, the example which I gave was of these, just the early years, again, of monastery down at Serpentine, just walking past the kitchen just before our lunch time. And there I saw, at that time we didn't have so much support, there was only a couple of monks, I saw there were 4 Thai Buddhists, they were making our lunch. And as I looked in the window, I saw every one of those 4 Thai women, very kind, you know, working hard, you know, making some good karma to feed the monks. And you can see what good job they did. As they were making the lunch, I noticed every one of those 4 were talking. They all had their mouths open, talking something. And because I was a mathematician before, a physicist, I started contemplating, if there were only 4 people in the kitchen and all 4 people are talking at the same time, how many people can be doing the listening? And obviously the answer was none. No one was doing the listening because everyone was doing the talking. What a waste of time that talking was. And every now and again you hear of what happens in Parliament. Everyone's doing the talking and no one is doing the listening. And you know, it's more important to do the listening, to have this silence. Now when I say just doing the listening, not doing the talking, some people are talking without their mouths moving. I'm not talking about ventriloquists. I'm talking about that you're maybe things going through your ears. Your mouth is not moving, but between your ears, in your brain, you're having this inner speech, this inner commentary, this inner, sometimes, reaction to what's being said. Your counter-argument, which means you're not really listening to what the other person is saying. You're listening to your reaction to them. You know, the counter-argument. And in order to understand what I really mean, sometimes I ask people, if you are going to watch a TV, especially if it's a sports match, is actually to turn off the sound, to mute it, and see how you can see what's happening on that football field or tennis field. And then if you do have the opportunity to see, it may be, say, Australia versus New Zealand in a rugby match or something. Listen to the Australian commentary next, and then listen to the New Zealand commentary. And you will find that they are totally different, even though they're describing the same match, the same incident. And then you listen to it in silence, and then you'll discover just what is really the most important and most accurate, and most reliable. It is the experience without the commentary. It's something which I used to call total listening, where you are sitting there, and you're not even trying to remember anything. You're not sort of going, this can't be right, this is not right, this is rubbish, this is not what should be said. You're actually totally listening. And then it's amazing just how much you understand and how much you remember. And I've often taught that at schools and universities as a way to learn efficiently. Because have you ever been to a lecture and actually you see that people aren't really listening? They are just either taking notes, which means half their mind is actually listening to the lecture and half is actually writing it down. And for many people these days, they've only got a half a brain, so I don't know how they can manage to actually... No, it's you are not really focusing, so it's not really going in. And I don't know where I got this from, but even as a young man, even going to primary school, I remember I had a very good memory. And it wasn't a photographic memory. All it was that when the teacher was teaching something, I'd be paying full attention. Didn't realize at the time, but when I look back upon that, I wasn't thinking. I was actually totally just absorbing what the person was saying. In this particular case, the teacher. So you could recall it afterwards. If you have a sponge and it's already wet, how can you actually absorb much water which is spilt on the table? If it's already doing something, it can't absorb very much. But if you can manage to squeeze out all that water, make a very dry sponge, it's amazing just how much that can absorb. That's just like the brain. If it is really dry in the sense of there's no chatter going on inside of it, no background noise, then it can actually absorb so much. It's a very efficient way of learning and absorbing information. But not just information. It's also a wonderful way of being able to talk to someone and then listen totally what they say next. You actually hear them. It comes right in. It's not just listening to their words, because sometimes the communication comes not just from words, but from so much other avenues of communication. Smells, body languages, and please excuse me, like mind to mind as well. You don't have to be a highly trained meditating monk to actually to read minds. We all read minds to a lesser extent, to a weaker extent, just because we know one another, we're looking at one another, and some interaction comes up. And I know this, and obviously as a monk who meditates, but also it answers another question. Somebody did send in a request for a talk about the addiction to social media for our interactions and getting to know one another and talking to one another. And the argument which I give against the usefulness of sending emails, even Skype messages or text messages, is so often there's so much in that communication which is missed out. Because you know that I travel a lot, going over to Singapore and to Indonesia, and later on go, I don't know where I'm going next. There's huge crowds go there, and it's very uncomfortable for people to sometimes come a couple of hours beforehand and be able to get a seat and be able to sit there and listen to everything. And I ask them, why do you do that? Can't you just log in and see the Friday night talk live streamed? Say, no, we can do that, but it's much different if it's live. You're right there. You're hearing it. Not just hearing it, you're being in it. And it's one of the reasons why it doesn't matter just how many talks I can give here or other monks and nuns give here and how well they're recorded, live streams. You'd think, look, why do you have to sit here and listening to this? Well, you could be at your home listening to this live on your internet, it's live streamed. And then you can turn up the air conditioner, you can put your legs out, you can have a cup of tea, or you can do all sorts of stuff, even have a cup of a glass of wine or whatever as you're listening to the Friday night talk. You feed up. But it's not the same. People come here because you know life. There's more communication happens. There's more of an interaction. Yeah, good old the Tibetan tradition, there's more of a transmission goes on when it's in front of you. That idea of a transmission, people think it's, oh, it's just Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, or even Mahayana. No, it's, you can understand how that happens in all tense of communication. Happens on so many different levels. Which is why, if you email your boyfriend or girlfriend, if you send them a text message, if you Instagram them, if you tweet, it's still, it's not sufficient. It's not the full communication, instead of just being there. I wish it was the full communication, because then I wouldn't have to travel around so much. So, you know, everybody in Indonesia just knows, you know, my talks, but it's different. I'm sitting up there in front of you, talking, just being together. That has a totally different sort of a communication power to it. But it's also, if one person is talking, the other person does have to do the listening, the silence, of being able to absorb what's happening out there. But that's the way we communicate with others, with actually, and learn a lot, by actually just suspending, you know, our ideas, our philosophies, our beliefs and what it should be done, what it shouldn't be done. Suspending that just so we can absorb. And it's incredible just how much we can learn from others, but also how much we can learn from life as well. Just in that silence is one of the great benefits of the power of silence. If the outside is silent, if you go to a quiet place, somehow it just resonates inside and it makes your mind, your brain silent. Many people keep saying, oh, they try and meditate, but their mind is too active. It thinks about this, it thinks about that. They've got so many worries, so many duties, so many problems in life. And, you know, I have my problems as well, much responsibility, things which I have to do, problems which I have to solve. But, you know, I've learned, you know, from great teachers like Ajahn Chah, just the power of silence. Just to be still and listen. First of all, the health of your body. To have a sense of awareness of your body. To get to know it, to get to feel it. The body is always telling you, teaching you. It's always giving you suggestions of whether you need to be moved, need to have a glass of water, to rest, to work. You know, we live a very busy life, and sometimes that people get tired. I know that. Getting old, decrepit, falling apart. We're still keeping it together, because I know just the power of just sitting down, resting. And it's not just resting, because people don't know how to rest these days. Keep on saying that sometimes you have a holiday. Hey, what am I going to do for my holiday? What do you mean, that whole question, what am I going to do for my holiday? Just be quiet. Don't do anything. Where are you going for your holiday? What do you mean, going? I often say this, that people here in a country like Australia, you've got this amazing house. You spent so much money getting a house, getting it comfortable, a nice bed, air con maybe. Just and as soon as you got a holiday, what do? You leave it and go somewhere else. It makes no sense to me. But you want to go on holiday. You know, it's holidays, they just tire you out even more. So, why don't you stay at home? No place like home. No bed like your own bed. No pillow like your own pillow. You snuggle into it. It's just whenever I go away and see my pillow again, oh, how are you going? It's just like, where have you been? And always get a really nice sleep because your own pillow, somehow or other, there's like a connection. You know, you're used to it. You know what I'm talking about. And so, a lot of times, if we can be silent, it's amazing just how we can relax. Our body is telling us, instead of believing what the noise says outside, people telling you, oh, you must go and see the Grand Canyon. You don't need to see the Grand Canyon. You just come and see some of the erosion after heavy rains in our monastery on the hills. Canyons all over the place. You haven't lived until you've seen the Great Wall of China. How many of you have seen the Great Wall of China? Anyone seen the Great Wall of China? I haven't seen the Great Wall of China. I've seen the Great Wall of Bodhinyana. That's great enough for me. How many of you have seen Niagara Falls? You got Serpentine Falls just around the corner from me. It's only size, that's all. What's the difference? So the point is, I was actually telling this to the monks the other day. I remember going to see the Taj Mahal many, many years ago. And being rebellious in nature, not just following what other people tell me, just sitting down and just looking from a distance and asking myself, what is beautiful about this? Why is it that people tell me it's beautiful? Why? And I just let my mind just be still, listen to the answers. Put that question in there, and it's amazing just what came out. It's just because people have told me it's beautiful, that you have to go and visit it. But architecturally, now where it came from, the amount of money and stuff, and just the resources which, you know, the ruler at the time put into that, to the expense of so many other things. Why? So a lot of times it was because I was believing what I was told. The whole culture had conditioned me to say, that's a beautiful monument. But I said, why? So that was where I could listen and actually challenge and find a deeper truth. But actually that was not really what I was pointing to, just listening even to your body. Now what is health? Are you really relaxed? Are you really comfortable? You can actually, when you listen, in other words, in silence, you can get so much wisdom just from your body. You try and talk and worry, thinking, giving names, and you don't really get to know it. The teaching, classical teaching, which I should have said a few minutes ago, is something you've heard before, but I cannot improve upon this. It was a very beautiful little anecdote which I read as a kid. It was a kid when I was interested in all different types of religions and paths and meditation techniques. And this was coming from the Lao Tzu, you know, from the Taoist tradition. And it just encapsulated to me just why silence is so powerful. And silence isn't dumb. Silence actually sees things on a deeper level, and it also gives you so much more appreciation of what really life is with silence. And that was the story of Lao Tzu. He had a monastery somewhere in China, and every evening he would go on a walk with a disciple, new disciple every day, give everyone a chance, and had this young fellow just joined the monastery. So he was selected to go on a walk with the master, just the two of them. But there was this very, very important rule that no talking while you were on the walk. You have to have silence, absolute silence, the golden rule. And he was doing well. They were walking and walking and walking, and they came to a ridge on the mountains at sunset. And it was just one of these amazing, beautiful sunsets, you know, with the golden light just streaking across the horizon, reds and yellows, and just, you know, the deep blue. It must be something to do with the contrast, the golds and the orange, you know, make the sort of the sun, the color of the sky just above and below, just this very, very deep, gorgeous blue color. And the student said, "Wow, what an amazing, beautiful sunset." He'd broken the rule, he'd talked. And Lao Tzu, he didn't just say, you know, "You've broken the rule." He turned around and walked back. I can't avoid this little funny story about the four monks in their vow of silence. When one sneezed, and the first monk said, "Bless you," and the second monk said, "You've just broken your vow of silence," and the third monk said, "Ha ha ha, so have you," and the fourth monk said, "At least I'm the only one here who can keep a vow of silence." Now that's not just a stupid joke, because that's actually saying something. Sometimes that if we try and describe silence or try and criticize it, it's destroyed. But with Lao Tzu, he actually walked back to the monastery with this fellow. Only when he came back to the monastery that he told his student, "You can't go on a walk with me ever again, you've broken that rule." And that was a bit extreme. So the friends of that young monk came up and said, "Oh, give him a break, it was only one word or one sentence. And what's wrong with saying what a beautiful sunset?" And this is the important point when I keep repeating the story in many different places and occasions. And Lao Tzu said, "When my student was watching that sunset and said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was just watching the words." Do you get that? Are you watching the sunset or are you watching the words? And I saw just the power of silence. Silence sees more deeply, more raw, more authentic. The words are just one step away from truth, one just little move away from reality. As soon as we try to describe it, we're not experiencing it anymore. Which is one of the reasons why when I feel my body in meditation, you try not to give it a name, not to describe it, not to try and put it into some sort of category, but just know it. Know it directly rather than through a word or a description. That's where you can really feel it, and you get to know it and understand it. And it's incredible just how healthy your body can become just by listening, paying attention, hearing it. Because I don't know how many times, you know, you have a difficulty or a problem, physical or emotional, and you feel that you're not being heard. Your body feels like that as well to you. You're not hearing it. You're giving it a name, you're assuming you know, but you haven't really grasped it. You haven't seen it. Which is one of the reasons why to communicate with others, to communicate with your body, you have to be silent, hear it. As soon as you give it a name, put it into a box, you've missed it. Just like you're not really seeing the sunset when you give it a name. Just stupid old Ajahn Brahm. When I was a layperson, I went over to actually the same time, just a few days before going to see the Taj Mahal for the first time. I went over to India. You know, I had just, I was a school teacher and I decided this is my last trip. I'm a Buddhist, I'm fed up with traveling, so I'm going to go and visit India, see the holy sites, come back, and then just relax, retire, no traveling anymore. Ha ha ha. And the next time I came over to Thailand to become a monk, and I've been traveling ever since. It's crazy. But anyway, all the things you intend to do, you usually tend to do something else, but you usually end up doing something else rather. But this particular time I went to India, one of the things I wanted to see was to see the Himalaya Mountains, because I saw some photos of them and they just were so amazing. I thought that's one thing I did want to see in my life. So I went over to India and of course I didn't do my homework and research. It was the monsoon season. So all you could see is clouds. Clouds all over the place. Couldn't see any mountains. After a few days, just gave up any hope of seeing the Himalayan mountains. But one day I was over in Kathmandu, and there was you know, you staying around with in a youth hostel with young people, and we found out there was the post truck. The post truck would actually deliver letters from Kathmandu, the center, over to the Tibetan border. And, you know, it weren't when we were supposed to do this, but the post driver, to get a few extra rupees, would allow a couple of travelers to go in the back of the post bus, you know, and take them to the Tibetan border, then come back again. So it was a really nice little trip. And so halfway up there, stopped for tea, and then there was a little hill, not a big hill, took about half an hour to get up. We climbed up, maybe 20 minutes, climbed up the hill, and as soon as we got to the top of the hill, the clouds parted. And you could see the clear range of the Himalaya mountains from far left to the far right. It was an amazing sight. You know what I did? I ran down the hill to get my camera. I don't know why I did this. Totally stupid. And as fast as I possibly could, I was much fitter and much thinner in those days. Ran down, got the camera out of my little bag, ran back up again, and as soon as I got to the top of the hill, I could just see the clouds came up and closed. Just maybe 10 seconds. And then there's another couple of travelers there, Americans. They were much smaller than I was. They were just sitting down there, just enjoying. And I said, "Where did you go?" And I missed everything. And I never saw those Himalayas for the whole trip, 3 months. That was my one chance. And I missed it because I wanted to capture it. And to me, there are some things in life you can never capture. And thank you, I learned my lesson there. It was worth it. Later on you see the Himalayas. But this time I miss them because I try to capture them. And to me, words try to capture something. I take photographs. And when you take the photograph, running up and down, trying to get, can we get the right angle, can we get the right exposure, when you try to take the photograph, you miss the event. How can you capture these things? So to me, I learned a lot from that. Even experiences in meditation, experiences in life. Try not to capture them with your thoughts. I must remember that. Stop that. Just experience it in silence. And in silence, when you actually feel the body, you feel an ache or a pain somewhere, there's something wrong, you feel it. If you try and give it a name, you really mess up what's going on. There's an ache there. Oh, that's my I've got an ache in my chest. Oh my goodness, that must be a heart attack. I've got a heart attack. Oh my goodness, I've got a heart. And you create a heart attack with all your stress. And all it really is because you're lying in bed and you've just been pressed on the wrong side or something. Or you have some other ache or pain or something. Be very careful of just how a thought, a description, is inaccurate, and it can lead into a cascade of fear, more thoughts, and a lot of problems. So this is one of the reasons why if you want to be healthy, learn to experience your body in silence. Don't judge it, don't give it a name, just be, feel. But that's even more important with your mental health. With your mental health, we always like to give things names. And this was one of those stories I learned in child psychology, being a school teacher. I had to do a course in psychology. And this was a famous, this is what happens when you give things a name. And names tend to stick on you. As I say, like Taj Mahal being gorgeous, or temples being too big, or Trump being a narcissist. Careful. because you believe that. And what happens is you create what you believe. Because this was the little story, an experiment, beautiful experiment. It was the kids involved, I hope they recovered from this. It was in UK many, many years ago, it was the two classes of children experiment. And when I read that, that really sent shivers in my spine. It changed a lot of how I looked at life. Children in the school, two classes, well, usually in those days about 30 in each class, at the end of the school year, so maybe like year 8 or 9 or something, it was considered to be, you know, not the most important year at school. But year 8 or 9, this was in UK, so they, only two classes in that year, the end of year exam. So they gave them the exam, but they never told the children the scores. It's only the principal and two psychologists who were doing this experiment were actually in on what was really happening. And what they did, once they got all the scores together, the child who came first, the top of those 60 kids, was assigned into the same class as the one who became 4th and 5th, 8th and 9th, 12th and 13th, 16th and 17th, and so on. The children who came 2nd and 3rd went in the other class, together with those who were 6th and 7th, 10th and 11th, 14th and 15th. In other words, they split those two classes up as evenly as possible, based on the scores of that end-of-year exam. And the principal was asked to find teachers for the next year who they thought were equally competent. Even classes with equal facilities, equal light. They made everything as equal as possible, except for one thing. They called one Class A and the other one Class B. That was the only difference. And the only people who knew why were the principal and two psychologists. They were exactly equal. But because of our conditioning, because of our assumptions based on that conditioning, we believe that A means the superior group and B means the second class group. So what happened is for one whole year, half those children, they went to Class A, the other went to Class B. Their parents, when they found out the results, look, I don't know how you've got into Class A, son. You've been just messing around all the time, getting into trouble, but well done. Congratulations, carry on. And this poor little girl who went into Class B, right, no more ballet lessons for you. No more sort of going out to party. You stay at home, extra work. Because they thought the Class B was the lower class. And even the teachers assumed that as well. And the children themselves assumed it. The teachers never taught to such a high standard. They never expected. They never pushed so much. Only Class B. And so the end of one year, when they gave the exam again, and that was really just the chilling part of it, the kids in Class A, even though they were the same the year before, they did so much better because they were labeled and classed as being superior. And they believed it, they became Class A kids. And those in Class B, obviously, because they were told they were Class B, they believed that. They weren't. They became Class B children. It's amazing just how we believe what we're taught. That commentary instead of the silence, that can cause huge amounts of problems with us when we are given names and labels and we believe them. So, it's the labels and beliefs which form the bricks and mortar of our inner thought. But where we can actually stop that, as a scientist, I was an astronomer as well. I was part of the Astronomical Society over in Cambridge, and we had some wonderful times going up into those big old old observatories. I remember there's one observatory where somebody found, I think they found Pluto, I think, in that observatory. And you could actually sit on the end of this huge dome and just do the needle and see these huge stars and these old telescopes. It was really cool. One of the best experiences I remember being at Cambridge, these really old observatories. And to be able to see those stars, and I soon got to know the names of them. And you know, once I became a monk, I could never look at the stars without naming them. And I lost the beauty, the wonder, because whenever I saw, oh, that's just Alpha Centauri over there, that's something, I just saw the names. And it took a lot of time, I managed to do this, to forget those names. So I could just see the stars like everyone else could see the stars, and they were beautiful, they were gorgeous. When I had the names, I lost the beauty. All I saw was the thoughts, not what it's like when there is stillness, silence, and the mind didn't move into words, but it could just experience. And that's one of the reasons why sometimes I used to go to some of these caves, or even I remember over in UK, just whenever I was in London, I would always try and find a quiet place just to restore my sanity, physical health and mental well-being. I go to places of quietness where I can find them. You know, my favorite place used to be this Westminster Abbey, because it was cavernous, it was huge, and it was quiet. No one went in there. It wasn't actually a tourist attraction in those days, a few tourists, but mostly open. You could walk in there, didn't have to pay anything. And I would always, you know, which was really sort of tired, needed a bit of a break, needed some respite, just go into some silence. And I love that place. And then I remember going in there just before I went to Thailand. I was getting all the visas, really messing around. And then went in there just for a bit of rest. And know what happened? I realized that the people running the place had installed a PA system. And there was constant noise, advertisements. When there wasn't any announcements, there was piped sermons. And it lost the quietness, the stillness, which I thought was a sacred part of the place. So the silence has a power, which is the power to restore health and also to restore sanity. I know that sometimes when a person is sick, physically or emotionally, and the two are connected together, sometimes people just, they want to counsel you, they want to talk. But you know, sometimes that talking is just more noise. For some, it's just leaving them alone, being quiet, being silent, and feeling that the silence is the healer. Bodhinyana Monastery. The hall there is a very quiet place. I remember many people going in there, meditating, whatever that is. That comes from Ajahn Brahm, meditation teacher. No, just allowing the silence to actually to soak into them. So, recalling, if anyone goes over there to see the big concrete water tanks, over 30 years old now, and the guy who built them, oh, great old Australian, he just did them by himself, a one-man job. It's amazing just what he did, so strong. And after he finished the job, he was just really dirty and a really nice fellow, but just so coarse and so, and he was talking, and I remember just the very end of the job, he said, you know, he'd call me Brahm, not Ajahn Brahm, you know, just, he's an Australian worker, Brahm. Hey, Brahm. I don't mind that at all. I mean, just a bit of friendliness. There's a time for respect and for saying this and that, but this was not a time for that. So, Brahm, would you mind if I have a look inside your church? He said. You know, it doesn't really know it's not a church, but, you know, who cares? And so I said, yeah, come along. So talking. I said, do I have to take my boots off? If you see like workers' boots, it would take half an hour to take those boots off. I said, no, come on. And so we went into the entryway, and I opened the door. He wouldn't go in on the carpet with his big boots, but he just put his head through to have a look. And I always remember that moment. It lasted about a couple of minutes. He was totally silent, stopped speaking. And I was not going to interrupt this, because you could feel that this was really important for him. And he just went, put his head inside there for 2 minutes, and he came out afterwards, just his head. And he looked at me with a big, many tooth missing smile. And he said, "Wow, this is good, ain't it, Brahm?" And just that small sort of way of describing it was, to me, so eloquent. He'd actually tasted the silence. He'd actually felt it. And all he could say, "Wow, this is really good." And he knew that he was really appreciating that, because he stopped all his talking. He was physically still, and he so much appreciated the power of silence. So sometimes I'm a bit of a hypocrite, talking so long. But I do that to try and point that sometimes, if you're ever really stressed out, go and find a quiet, silent place. Not sort of with the earbuds in, listen to music. Not sort of a place where there is a lot of noise. Even to me, that sometimes going to the beach, that's quite noisy. Forests, caves, little temples, places which we're so fortunate in Australia. Big country. You don't have to go that far into the bush where it's totally silent. And don't be afraid of it. Allow it to really sink into you. And it's amazing for your health and also for your mental well-being as well. In that silence, things heal. In that stillness, you understand the meaning of life, the purpose, what this really is. Trying to give it a name. In the old days, there was never statues of the Buddha. There was empty seats. There was footprint with no one with a foot there. An empty seat with no one sitting in it. A Bodhi tree with no one sitting underneath it. It was taking away those images, taking away the words, emphasizing the silence. When there's nothing there, just stillness. That is deeply in the heart of what we're doing here. Which is one of the reasons why, if you ever go to a quiet place, please, it's sacred. Respect it. Let it heal you, both physically and emotionally. Thank you. Sadhu. Okay, any comments or questions on the power of silence? Yeah? Over. Firstly, here comes. Okay, yeah.
I was just wondering, when you talk about silence and being like happy in silence, how do you not be kind of scared of it? How do you just like relax into it?
It's scared of silence. It's because we're not used to it. We don't respect it. We always want to fill it with something. It challenges us. And it's one of the reasons, when we first moved into the land for Bodhinyana Monastery, when people would visit, they would always shout. They would actually raise their voices. And I couldn't understand that at first, until I realized that people felt very challenged by silence. Because it took away who they thought they were, their personality, their comfort zone. the thoughts is like the comfort blanket people have to give them some control and some idea of the world. I don't know if you remember those old Grimm's fairy tales when I was a young kid, Rumpelstiltskin. You don't know that name? Okay, oh good, I'm glad you remember that, because apparently there was this, I don't know, magician or demon or spirit or something, I forget what he was really called, but there was this poor lady who was a weaver, and he said that you can weave gold out of straw, but if you don't find out my name, you'll have to marry me tomorrow or something. And so she had to find out his name, and eventually she found out Rumpelstiltskin. And so, you know, he had to sort of let her go. But I always remember many, many times where if you knew somebody's name, you had power over them. This was like an ancient, almost like magic of middle-aged Europe. You had power if you knew someone's name. And so you can see that when you put a name onto things, it gives you power. But when you have no names, for many people we feel lost. We don't know how just to be and let go with something which hasn't got a name. So it means no control. It means letting it be. So that scares people. But, you know, people actually experience the silence, and it feels amazing. It is spiritual, it's mystic, it's religious, it's holy. But why do people keep on interfering and destroying it? That's why even just in those ancient Abrahamic religions, you would never sort of give God a name. I still remember one of the great religious movies, The Life of Brian. Remember the person got stoned because he mentioned the word Jehovah. Oh, my wise fish, this was good enough for Jehovah. Stone him. You're not supposed to name it. And it was okay, you know, you can make fun of it, but there's a meaning behind that. Keep it silent. The sacred things. Now, things like silence, the forest, the bush. Shh. Silence is powerful. Okay, we got anything from anywhere else? Okay, what about the internet? Oh, you got it over there. Okay, so there's a question from overseas. Here we go. From Sweden, USA, and Canada. How do you keep silent and peaceful when someone is teaching over talking and being disrespectful to you? Is disrespectful to who? So sometimes there was, I'm thankful for this because there was one of our monks, he was a caretaker here many years ago. I don't know, remember Jasper? Jasper Hansen? Okay, he became a monk. But anyway, I remember that he said that what really inspired him to be a Buddhist and later a Buddhist monk, he disrobed after a while, but he went to a talk by a Tibetan Buddhist monk in a library in Melbourne. And it was very rare to get any monk to give a talk, especially someone who could speak English. So the monk came in, and you know, this Jasper, he was seated down there, and as soon as he got up to the podium, there was this fundamentalist Pentecostal Christian stood up and said, "This is evil, get him out of here, this is a path to hell, if you listen to this, this is not the teachings of Jesus." And you know, sometimes you see some of these people just getting very aggressive. And this Tibetan monk, he just stood there, just peaceful. You know, even though this person was interrupting him, saying ridiculous things. And all the people there were being very kind and gentle. Said, "Look, no, okay, you said your bit. Now please let the monk. We come here to listen to the monk, not to you." But that just kept this extremist religious person just getting more and more angry. And he kept on going for 1 hour, and that was all the time they had this hall in this library for. So the monk never had a chance to say anything. But Jasper and many others were so impressed by his silence. It's not what he said, but what he didn't say, which spoke volumes for the teachings and the training of a Buddhist monk. He never got angry. He was peaceful, not frustrated, so smiling peacefully, but not, not narcissistically or whatever. Just with a smile of superiority, but just gentle kindness. Not arrogantly, that's what I was looking for. And he was silent, he was peaceful, he was kind for 1 hour. And that was tipped this young man to being a Buddhist. So I thought that was amazing, that sometimes someone is teaching over talking, being disrespectful to you. Sometimes being silent, you win the argument, especially if it's about spiritual matters. Silence is so powerful. Let them speak. You be silent and find out who is winning the argument. From USA, if one is talking too much, is that because of ego? Does remembering non-self-anatta help to get rid of ego? Of course it helps to get rid of ego. And if one is talking too much, a lot of time it is because of controlling. I have to do this, okay? But you know that my preference will always be 6 months in my cave, in another hut, in total silence, never spoke a word to anybody. That was wonderful. But people say that's a bit too much, you should talk a little bit anyway. But talking too much, is that because of ego? Yeah, but it's also because of fear as well. And from Canada, I'm a new Buddhist. What is the best way to deal with a very angry husband who thinks Buddhism is useless and stupid and belittle your choice of being Buddhist all the time? Okay, so it's a challenge to you to prove him wrong. Not by words, but by behavior. So, I'm a new Buddhist. What's the best way to deal with a very angry husband who thinks Buddhism is useless and stupid and belittles your choice of being a Buddhist all the time? You could tell him that little joke. I said it just an hour ago, about the advice of a master to the disciple. So the disciple asks, "Master, can you please give me some advice?" And the master says, "Never argue with an idiot." And the disciple says, "That's a bit harsh, isn't it?" And the master replies, "Yes, I agree with you." I wouldn't try that on your husband. It might end up in a divorce. But anyhow, don't argue if it makes him angry. Just say, "Okay, darling, you know, it's a free country, you know, you can go your way, I can go my way, but we'll see if, you know, you can actually see if I become a better wife, a kinder wife." And that's usually what happens. Just, you know, you can go his way, you can go your way, you can still be kind and be a good companion. And you know, after a while, I don't think Dennis would mind me saying this, because Dennis, his first wife, would never come here, except for the ceremonies. Very good wife, always be very supportive. But when she got cancer and his first wife was dying, Dennis said, "It's amazing. Just, she never came to the temple in those days. And, you know, she's got all this Buddhist wisdom. And it's just come from, like, osmosis." She never listened to a talk, but obviously listening to someone who was so immersed, you know, in Buddhism, as Dennis was, it was just his character. She learned from the character, not from the books, not from the talks, but just from, you know, who, you know, our current president is. That's how she learned. That's amazing. So you don't have to take your husband to the temple or say, "Read the book or else I'm not going to give you any dinner." Just be a good person. If you're a new Buddhist, and if this path is worth anything, it will make you a better human being. And I think that is what your husband will see. Not the theories, not the practices, not the robes, not the chanting, not Vaisak ceremonies or whatever. It's whether you become a better, healthier, good person. That is what will impress them. It has many benefits. I can't help saying this little anecdote recently, because when I go travelling, oh, I get looked after so well. So just on the flight, just from here over to, first of all, to Singapore, and then Singapore to Medan, just sitting down minding my own business, and a captain comes up to see me. And he said, "No, you're Ajahn Brahm." You know, pretty dead giveaway, because some robes and stuff. And he says, my wife spent such a long time in bed with you." And then he laughed, because he says she listens to you because she had a cancer, a bad cancer, and you know she's got through it, but it's very painful and very sort of uncomfortable, and apparently that she was listening to the talks to actually to get her through that difficult time. And then all the time in the middle of the night or early morning. And so he said, "You know, my wife, Singapore, she found out you're coming to Singapore to give the talk, where Leha was at that talk. And so, you know, I was on the captain of the Singapore Airlines flight, so she told me to come and see you and to make sure you were really looked after." And of course I was. So, yeah, he saw the effect this had on his wife, to the point that, you know, he was an English person. He said, "Thank you so, so much." That's how you respect these teachings of Buddhism. And that's how I, as a teacher, get so many perks and benefits. But I told him after, he said, "Anything you want. You know, just the captain is the person who basically owns the plane. What do you want?" And I said, "Look," and honestly, just him telling me that is all I really wanted. That made me happy for days. Just that, you know, you've done something really for somebody, made them happy, got them sort of their wife through a very difficult time, and also inspired him. So that is how to deal with husbands or wives who think Buddhism is useless and stupid. Don't argue with them. Just prove them through your actions that it is very beautiful and very good, and makes you into a better person. They see that. Okay, any other comment, question before we finish off? Okay, so now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then I can be silent.
Pano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.